Welcome to the Rights Track Podcast, where we aim to get the hard facts about human rights challenges facing us today. In Series 1, we talk to academics who have dedicated their research to the systematic analysis of human rights problems. In Series 2, we talk to human rights advocates and practitioners involved in the struggle for human rights to learn more about their work and the ways in which academic and other research helps them. I'm Todd Landman. In today's episode, we're asking, what are the human rights issues associated with being a journalist? My guest is Elizabeth Witchell, Impunity Campaign Consultant with the Committee to Protect Journalists, an advocacy group that promotes press freedom worldwide and defends the right of journalists to report the news without fear of reprisals. The CPJ recently published its 2016 Global Impunity Index, which spotlights countries where journalists are murdered and their killers go free. So welcome, Elizabeth. It's great to have you here on this episode of The Rights Track.
Thank you for having me, Tom.
This is a phrase I keep hearing when I travel around the world, and in particular when I've been in Mexico. People have said to me, one of the most dangerous jobs you can have in Mexico is being a journalist. What do you think about that general statement, and how does that relate to the work that you've been doing?
So globally speaking, we have documented over many years what I think most people would find a startlingly high number of journalists who are killed, and within that number, a huge proportion that are actually targeted and murdered. So when I talk to just people who are not involved in journalism, and even some journalists who work in safer environments, they're not always aware of what journalists in many countries are facing on a daily basis. And the journalists that we work with are routinely threatened. They're routinely harassed for just reporting on local subjects. They might be reporting on criminal activities in their country. They might be reporting on corruption among local politicians, but they're very vulnerable because there's often a lack of protection. There's of legal protection and physical protection. There's often corruption within their systems that allow anyone who wants to intimidate a journalist to get away with it. So we really see a large range of dangers confronting journalists around the world. And Mexico is, of course, one of the most dangerous places that we look at. Journalists there work under a very heavy climate of fear and intimidation, to the point that there are certain subjects that they won't cover, or they are forced to cover anonymously, or they cover through social media because they can no longer put their names on a byline. So this particularly is the case when it comes to reporting on drug trafficking or on what's going on in some of the cartel-dominated states.
Right. So Mexico is one of the countries that features in your Global Impunity Index, which really looks at 13 countries in depth and in focus. So what makes a country qualify to be on the top list of 13 that you've got in the index?
This is an annual index, and we have a methodology that we apply, which is we take a 10-year period. In this case, this last index, most recent index, that 10-year period ends August 31st in 2016. So it goes from basically mid-2006 to mid-2016. And we take all the murders during that period, and within those, we look at the countries where there's been five or more murders with complete impunity. To take a slight step back, when we talk about impunity, we mean that no one has been prosecuted. Nobody has been held to account for murdering a journalist. And the way we decide whether there's impunity is we look at whether there's been a conviction. So we take countries that have five or more journalists who have been murdered with impunity. And then within those, we take the number of murders divided by the population, and we rank those countries.
Okay, so it's like a per capita calculation. And what made you decide on five? So for people who don't know, is that, is five a large number, a small number? You know, in a place like Mexico, is that a typical number that you see? So what's the sort of distribution of murders, if you will, across some of these more offending states?
Five is the lowest number that appears in the index, and it ranges. I would say about a third of the countries have only five murders within that period, five unsolved murders within that period. But then we have countries like Iraq that have over 100 murders that have taken place during that period. So it can go quite high, and it depends on the circumstances. But yes, you know, five is a high number. And we chose it. We didn't go lower than that because we wanted to look at countries where we thought there might be some sort of pattern. So by going lower than five, we thought, well, you know, we're not really reflecting what might or might not be a serious endemic problem in that country.
Yes. And are you interested in people who disappear?
The organization tracks journalists who disappear as well. They're not reflected in this particular report, which is only looking at murders. But indeed, it's an enormous problem, particularly in Mexico and in Syria. And we don't count them as murders till we know. But it's certainly equally as intimidating, it's equally as chilling to journalists, to the rest of the media in that country who has the same effect, I would say, as a murder of sparking fear and encouraging self-censorship.
Yeah, so that's a really interesting point, that this state of fear, if we might want to call it, for lack of a better word, or that sort of privatization of politics, that people are quite worried about saying things outright, kind of hushes conversation. And this notion that you encourage self-censorship by creating that state of fear. And is that something you see across the countries that you're looking at?
Yes, very much so. And, you know, it's kind of a hard thing to categorically document. Some of it's anecdotal. You know, we have in some countries taken pretty thorough look at whether there's self-censorship going on. For example, in Colombia, we once interviewed a large number of journalists that we felt we could conclusively say there was self-censorship going on. Then you have countries like Syria, where you see large numbers of journalists having to go into exile. So that's another kind of censorship that takes place. And then you have journalists who can't get the information out or who have to stay in hiding. So they're not able to operate as journalists. So, you know, you can look at very different forms of self-censorship.
Yeah. And so when journalists write in these precarious situations, what are some of the techniques, I guess, they're using? And they must find new technologies and some of the sort of privacy of networks, et cetera, can assist them in getting information out that then gets put back together, if you will, by a diaspora of supporters who are not in the country. I mean, that must be one of the techniques.
So yes, you certainly see a lot of different systems and different networks taking place. A lot of firsthand reporting is getting broadcast from outside a country. A protective measure you see sometimes in places like Mexico is a sort of syndicate that doesn't put any one person's name on the reporting. So no one's actually putting their own byline on the work. So that's another creative way journalists will come together to try to promote their own safety. And people are relying a lot on citizen journalism, and that's playing a more prominent role.
Yeah, could you tell us a bit more about citizen journalism? Some people call it citizen science. So this is crowdsourcing information from people using new technologies. So how does that work? Are there sort of networks that people contact, or are they just looking for things that are people willing to put on public domain that can then be scraped and analyzed, in a modern way?
Yeah, I will be honest, it's not my real area of expertise, but, you know, there's a lot of applications of it. You have the larger media outlets, people like the BBC, who have pretty robust vetting systems in place where they're really looking at the kind of information and footage they receive and ensuring its accuracy and able to fact check it. Coming out of Syria, you have, and Iraq as well, in some of the more dangerous areas and areas held by Islamic State, you see, you know, people have really come together to organize their citizen journalism and getting it out. And then, as you mentioned before, it'll be kind of packaged in exile and created at the same time, of course, this a larger array of avenues to get your information out. But then you also see a heightened amount of risk. You have a lot of people operating as journalists who might not have the same breaks, the same safety guards that traditional journalists do. So that is, I would say, one of the issues that we see as time goes on.
And what can you say about the perpetrators of these murders? Because you made sort of, you know, oblique reference to various groups not wanting journalists to investigate particular stories, etc. So could you say a bit about the types of stories that elicit violence and also the types of perpetrators that are committing it? Because these are not all state agents and not all criminal elements. There must be a whole blend of different actors committing these murders.
No, we do see a kind of blend, and it varies in different countries. There's a lot of different situations that we see violence against journalists taking place and causes for that impunity. But a few of the dominant trends, I would say, is probably seeing the most number of murders of journalists committed with impunity in countries where there's conflict and where you have militant extremist groups that have taken hold in certain parts. So you have Iraq, you have Syria and Somalia, where two things are happening. You have essentially a breakdown in law and order, so that it is actually possible to target journalists under a kind of cover of war or a cloud of conflict without repercussions. And then you also have, you know, these groups trying to protect their image, trying to use the media for their own ends. They have their own kind of war they're waging with the media to get the coverage that they want. So that's kind of one category. The other category, I would say, is journalists who are covering corruption or local politics critically. They're often working provincial areas outside the main cities of their countries. From what we can see, it looks like they've been targeted by people in positions of power, whether they're government officials, whether they're part of the police or military, or sometimes powerful business people who have like kind of the means and the influence to keep an investigation from going the way it should go. So it kind countries where we see that are the Philippines, Brazil, and Mexico to some extent, although that's more criminal groups as well. So those are kind of the two scenarios that concern us the most. You have, I would say, a country like Pakistan, where the journalists are really getting it from all sides. You kind of see all these different factors coming into play. And there's just so many no-go zones for journalists, political no-go zones and physical no-go zones, that it just becomes too dangerous to cut the things the way they need to.
But the desire to tell stories is still very strong. And of course, the exercise of free speech is very much a powerful motivation. And so people are willing to take risks to continue to report, I guess.
Yeah, it amazes me when I have to take a pretty close look at these cases, and I'm always full of respect and appreciation for the risks that people are taking, for the reasons that they're doing it, uncovering often very important stories. One of the cases that we highlighted in the Philippines is a journalist who was uncovering local corruption, illegal mining, and he was murdered in Somalia. A journalist was murdered covering human rights abuses by locally operating militias. In Russia, there's a journalist who was beaten into a coma and then killed after he was trying to stop development of a local forest. And so these journalists are really working for they really want to see their communities improve. They're really trying to shine a spotlight on the things that need to be shown. There's a journalist in India who was investigating allegations that a local politician had raped a girl in their community, and he was killed.
The other thing I'm curious about is that beyond the work on the Index, for example, you're an organization that raises awareness about all of these abuses and the impunity, etc. But does your organization also, you talk about investigating cases, researching cases, do you advocate on behalf of people who've been killed? So are you trying to seek justice as well as raise awareness and report on violence that's taking place?
Yeah, our goal with our impunity campaign is very much to see justice. And then that is actually a stepping stone to the ultimate goal, which is to reduce these attacks, reduce violence against journalists.
Do you work with a larger network then? So you're one organization. Are there other networks you can work with? Is there an umbrella organization or other sort of international groups that you find, your collaborations are quite fruitful in this regard?
Yeah, absolutely. We work within something called the International Freedom of Expression Exchange, which is an umbrella group of freedom of expression groups around the world. So they have taken up this issue of impunity strongly, and so they help coordinate between us and other international groups, but then also coordinating with local groups who are advocating for specific cases in their own countries. And then in recent years, we've seen a real increase in international attention from intergovernmental agencies, and particularly from the UN. So we have been trying to ensure that attention is translated into action and ultimately into actual prosecutions on the ground. So in recent years, we've seen the development of something called the UN Plan of Action for the Protection and Safety of Journalists and the Issue of Impunity, and that was introduced by UNESCO. There's also been three Human Rights Council resolutions and a UN General Assembly resolution. And one of the results from that has been the introduction of something called the International Day to End Impunity in Crimes Against Journalists. So there's now an International Day on this issue, which we welcome for bringing attention. But of course, ultimately, what we really want to see is states respond on their national level and truly, truly ensure that there are prosecutions in these cases.
Yeah, because the ultimate justice would really take place in the local jurisdiction at a state level, is that right?
Our advocacy, and I think other groups as well, is aimed towards creating enough of a stink, if you will, enough of a stir so that there's pressure on the state to put the resources into prosecuting journalists, to take other steps that are necessary. So some of those steps that we encourage countries to take are a kind of national level prosecutor or investigative team that can look into some of these cases, because often the local authorities might be implicated or influenced in some way. So to have some sort of outside authority also oversee these cases can push justice forward. We want to see these states comply with regional judgments. Some cases have gone to regional courts and been adjudicated there, but then those decisions are not really implemented by the national states. So what we really want to see is that sort of trickle down to a local level.
All the work that you've done and worked on the Index and the research you've done, is there any way that you could maybe offer a a conclusion or an inference about trends. So is the world becoming a worse place for journalists or a better place, or it's just so variable that there's no way to say whether it's better or worse. You just keep working on the cases that you work on.
Well, I guess I would say it's the best of times and the worst of times. You have, you know, technology has created incredible opportunities for journalism and ability to get different points of view out and for information across borders and for people to publish on this small level. So on one hand, we're seeing an explosion of terrific journalism and opportunities for journalists and for the dissemination of news. Then, of course, with that has come with an upsurge of risks. So I would say we are looking at very dangerous times for journalists, but I wouldn't necessarily say it's the worst of times, because at the same time, there's quite a lot of exciting things going on.
Yeah, no, that's really fascinating. And I guess my final question is, in the Iraq war, we saw this idea of the embedded journalist. And I wondered what the organization's view is on that, because there was a lot of question around the authenticity, credibility, and impartiality of an embedded journalist. And I'm curious if you have an official view on that, if there's been any kind of work from your side on that particular phenomenon.
Well, the main thing is that being embedded can give you access to the front lines. And a lot of journalists make that choice because there is some safety and there is some access. But from our point of view, we want to be sure that there's no strings attached, that the coverage that those journalists can give, it can be as nuanced and multifaceted as feels appropriate. And then you shouldn't be restricted to covering a situation by only being embedded. It's dangerous, but if journalists can proceed carefully, report, getting all sides of the story, I think some of the best reporting has come from covering not just what's going on with the troops and what's going on with the military side. There's a civilian side, and that's not something you're going to see by being embedded.
And there was that amazing case in Mosul recently of the CNN journalist who was trapped for 48 hours or 24 hours, I think, in the fight against ISIL. So that was a real kind of quite vivid, salient reminder of the precariousness of this work.
Yes. No, and I think, you know, what I hear from journalists a lot today is it's a very changing game right now. Things are very different than they were 10 years ago. The front line moves, what people often call the red line of sort of danger line, is very fluid. And it is, in that sense, becoming more and more dangerous. I mean, people just often find themselves in very unexpected dangers, going to situations that they did not think were, that finding that they very much are.
Yeah, so that sort of surprise element there. Finally, Elizabeth, if you could tell us, what would you consider some of the major successes, one or two major successes that your organization has been able to achieve?
So we have definitely, I would say, seen, I think, a small, but some increase in the number of convictions on the ground. So, you know, with every single conviction, we see that as a kind of victory. So over the last year, there's been convictions in, well, nearly 11 cases, and that's quite a lot. So that's something that I think I see as a victory, in seeing that this issue has become an international issue and become part of the global discussion, and it's become part of, integrated into development concerns, whether countries are encouraging safety of journalists and creating an environment that's safe and prosecuting these murders. So I see that as something to be proud of. You know, we work every year trying to get journalists released from prison. So our upcoming census will be coming out on which journalists are in prison. And every year we campaign to get those journalists released. And we see, it's different every year, so we see several cases of journalists getting out of prison. We have recently helped put together something called a Culture of Safety, ACOS. It's an alliance that's promoting the safety of freelance journalists and trying to encourage media outlets to understand what are kind of standard safety conditions, what steps can be taken to improve their safety, and encourage media outlets to work with freelancers to make sure that they have access to all the equipment and all the measures that they need to create a safer work environment. So I guess I would say there's quite a few.
But it's really important for our listeners to know that these efforts lead to something. You know, sometimes we think about the futility of human rights work. So it's really good to hear the positive outcomes. There have been some convictions. People have been let out of prison, and there's serious work being done on this very, very serious issue. So, I mean, I thought it was a fascinating conversation about the precarity of some of this work, you know, the threats, the need for advocacy, the way in which networks work, this sort of transnational advocacy network that is yielding positive results, and that all this hard work can lead to positive change. So for now, I just wanted to thank you very much for spending time with us on the Rights Track, and thanks very much again.
No, well, thank you for putting a spotlight on this issue.
This episode of The Rights Trap was presented by Todd Landman and produced by Chris Garrington of Research Podcasts. Series 2 of the podcast is funded by the Economic and Social Research Council. More information, including all the podcast episodes from Series 1 and accompanying show notes for each of our interviews, is available on our website at www.rightstrack.org.